I mean, I want a human being selling to another human being.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want them to infect me with the enthusiasm that they have for gear A, B, and C.
And we're back, episode 34, Not an Audio File, season 2. David's back in the studio today to illuminate us with his thoughts on perception in relation to hi-fi, and I'm here to discuss turntables and 10 key ideas to get the best from them. Are you craving incredible sound? I think we all are. Well, those listening to this podcast. For over 47 years, Len Wallace Audio has been guiding hi-fi enthusiasts on their audio journey. They're not some corporate machine, just a tight-knit crew of audiophiles and entertainment lovers obsessed with great sound. From precision turntables to immersive home theatre systems, they handpick gear that delivers. Stop by the store in Lane Cove, Sydney, Australia, or visit lenwallaceaudio.com. Len Wallace Audio, where your passion finds its sound. And today's Hi-Fi Rant Unfiltered is yet again not an actual rant. It's me just talking about, I don't know, well, vintage hi-fi is an interesting thing. Yet again, a new, do we call it faux vintage hi-fi product has been released, the new Quad 3 Integrated. It looks fantastic. As the press is saying, it's sort of a New World Order, or a New World version at least, of a of the original Tube preamp. It looks, I like it. I like it a lot. In fact, there's a whole bunch of new hi-fi that I kind of want to buy just because it sort of looks good. And I guess it's a little bit of nostalgia. Maybe it's a lot of nostalgia. But then that is what vintage hi-fi purchases, I think, largely are. And so my point is, at what point does nostalgia become more important than sound quality or vice versa? Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm not sure genuinely 40 to 50-year-old hi-fi components that even if they have had some time and repairs lavished upon them, that they really sound, well, they sound good. They sound like I think people want, which is a bit warm, a bit slow, a touch dirty, kind of easy to listen to, but sometimes I just find them a little, ultimately just a bit oldie, excessively oldie-worldy, a little bit too coloured and distorted. Yeah, maybe that's just my take. I mean, mileage does vary dramatically. Some of the things that we see through the workshop are surprisingly great sounding once completed, and but others are great, but just so the new ones, the new Musical Fidelity A1, the I believe it was a special edition, there's a limited number built, but the Nate, the you know, copy of the original Nate that Name did for a while, is a cool looking thing. This new Quad is amazing. Of course, there's the Quad 303 combo, which also looks pretty good. It's got a few odd screws here and there that the original one didn't have, and it's not quite as clean looking, but it is new and fresh and scratch free. So I guess there's two ways you can go. You want the old look, you want the new sound, and you're willing to pay for it, or you really want the old sound and you actually want the old look. So I guess everyone's happy. But for those that are sitting on the fence and are not sure what's for them, from the point of view of reliability and sound quality, I'm going to say a new product is better for you. It probably will come at a higher price. And it's not just those retro revivals that new products that that you need to think about. There are other brands that really, well, there's other brands like, say, Moon River, who've done a very nice job of sort of, for me, conjuring sort of Sansui from the 70s and 80s very nicely with a beautiful looking new product. And they've seemed to be doing pretty well with that over the last few years since they conjured that up. And then there's other brands like Accuphase and Luxman, to a large degree, are making largely what they did 40 years ago. A lot of the guts of the styling, if you like, is the same. Now, does it sound better or worse? Well, the AccuPhase absolutely sounds better, and I'm sure the Luxman does as well. But the old Luxman and the old AccuPhase sounded very, very good anyhow, and are probably the exceptions to, or some of the exceptions to my sort of rule that maybe the older genuine gear doesn't sound as good. But for those thinking, no, no, it's the old gear for me, I don't care if it's got a few scratches and it's not quite right, just be aware there are, it's 40 years old, it's 45, it's 50 years old. Everything in that box is that age. There is no possible way of restoring that to brand new condition. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. There is just no way to do it. The switches are not available. The pots are not really available. The socketry will always be old. I guess the transformer will always be old, but it should be okay. But you can put small signal transistors and capacitors in it as much as you want, but there's and even resistors, but there's so many other things. And then there's all the cable. I mean, really, it's 50 years old. So you should look for originality. That's what I say to everyone. If you are looking for an older unit, really try to find something that's a little bit, yeah, maybe one or two owner, you know where it's been. Don't buy it from the other side of the planet. Try to see it before you can buy it. And of course, making sure that it's transported in such a way that it arrives to you in the great condition that it perhaps has currently been retained in for such a long time. Those are just my brief thoughts. And on with the show. March Audio. Fantastic amplifiers. Alan March has been on the show a couple of times. He's a great guy. Very, very smart cookie, and he manufactures a range of amplifiers and loudspeakers using Purify components in most cases, which we all know are extremely high quality. So check out March Audio, great sound, brilliant build quality and design, and in fact, I believe there is a new preamp, which is a ground-up design of their own, coming out from literally a clean sheet of paper, marchaudio.com. And we're back with David Karatsa and myself, Andrew Hutchison, discussing various bits of hi-fi malarkey. Specifically today, David, perception. Perception. Correct. Of what, sir?
Well, perception of how things sound. And by that I mean people will walk into a store, they'll listen to brand XYZ, and because it is brand XYZ, they'll think, it must have this quality. Mm. And this is quite distinct from sitting down and objectively, subjectively listening. It's about all the marketing and social and cultural preconceptions that come with the brand.
You've kind of been preloaded to Definitely. Think it might produce a certain kind of sound.
I think so. I think that's par for the course. I don't think that's anything new. I think most listeners would appreciate what I'm trying to say. Yeah,
I think to some degree, not an audiophile. It's not that we have a big hang-up or a problem with the concept of the audiophile, the enthusiast for audio equipment.
Correct.
I think the name's a little silly, but that's another story. It didn't used to be in such popular usage. Now it seems to be widely accepted. But it's the slight silliness that sometimes goes on where these mental tricks, if you like, perhaps are discounted or ignored. So we're going to talk about that, or at least you are.
Thank you.
And I am going to talk about how to make, or how to get the best from a turntable. Turntables are back for good, it seems. They're as embedded now as they were in the 70s and 80s, although they were done away with in the 80s to some degree, for some people, lots of people. But 70s, the LP ruled. The 80s, it faded a little, but in fact, the LP's been back now longer than it left for almost.
That's
it's
a good point.
It's almost been back long because it came back in 2010, roughly. For some people, it never went away.
Yep.
So approximately 2010, and clearly it's 2025. So yep. We've had 15 years of very strong love of the format. It's about time people understood how to get the best from it.
Oh, I totally agree. The thing that disappoints me, I guess that's the word, dismays me, I guess. And it's no individual's fault, is that a lot of people, with the best of intentions, will buy a turntable or, as they say, record player. And whether it's $500 or $5,000, a lot of the time it's not set up correctly.
I would say, okay, I see a very narrow – you see a different audience of turntables out in the retail world, but stuck in a workshop, you clearly only see the faulty ones or the ones that need attention or the ones where people have decided they need attention, but you're absolutely right. Almost, I would say, never is a turntable set up correctly when it arrives. But then many cases people have made a major faux pas and shipped it to us with the platter still on, the armour swinging.
Oh, yeah.
The stylus are flinging. It's yeah, it's in pieces by the time it gets you, having, you know, sat in the back seat. Well, I would put my turntable on the front seat or the back seat of the car. I always feel like the seat gives it a little extra cushioning. But people turn up with it in the boot, with it in the boot of the car, the trunk.
Oh.
And there's like an old shovel rolling around in there and a bale of hay and...
Look, it's true.
And a dog blanket. It's wrapped in the dog blanket. Oh,
yes.
Dear, oh, dear.
Classy.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, anyhow. Now, we're going to take a quick break.
Mm-hmm.
Not an Audiophile is a media partner of the 2025 StereoNet Hi-Fi and AV show. This year, it's bigger than ever. Hi-Fi, home cinema, headphones, 3 days of what is basically a home entertainment expo from the 29th to the 31st of August in Melbourne, Pullman Hotel. More details at stereonet.com. And we are back. David Carazza is here today with a discussion on perception of all things related to audio, and I'm here to discuss how to get the best from your turntable, 10 things you need to take into account or else. David.
Okay, let's quickly talk about perception. I don't want to ramble incessantly about this, but I think it's something we all need to be aware of. And this is a multi-layered thing. I think the hobby that we love is riddled with perceptual tripwires, for want of a better word.
Tripwires. I like that. Tell us about these tripwires.
It's okay. It's and this is not a judgment. It's merely an observation. So regardless of where you are in the hobby, whether you're just starting out and you've just discovered stereo imaging and holography and dynamic range and all those beautiful things that make this hobby a wonderful thing to pursue, or you're a seasoned veteran with, you know, many decades under your belt and have been exposed to a lot of different systems and a lot of different price points, I think the salient point is that we're humans and we are impressed upon, not just by marketing forces, but by... oddly enough, the aesthetics of the gear that we play through.
Absolutely.
And certainly, sad to say, the price tag.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah, yeah. So your point, Ree, the price tag is that, you know, if it's a $10,000 anything, component, speaker, system, whatever, what have you, that it's got to sound good. Is that...
But pretty much, I think the assumption.
Or maybe does it cut the other way, where if it's super inexpensive.
Yeah, it can't sound good.
It can't sound good. And then when it sounds vaguely acceptable, then it seems way. It seems like an amazing value, like.
Correct.
The brand with the two eyes in it.
Which we shall not talk about. Well, look, you know, it's. And historically, this has been manifest over the years. I mean. For those of you who are old enough to remember when Harry Pearson was editing The Absolute Sound back last century, there was one of these pivotal moments in hi-fi when he had a huge Infinity reference system, speaker system, one of the iconic systems of the 80s.
Okay.
And he took a baby NAD 3020 amp, integrated amp, $199 US, 20 watts a channel.
Yeah.
And lordy, lordy, it drove the IRSs. Now... In any reasonable universe, you would think this is sheer madness, but it happened.
Well, yeah, now they're probably notoriously hard to drive, the freaky impedance curve and phase response, I guess. I don't – in fact, I'm pretty sure they do. In fact, I'm very sure they do. But what was he trying to achieve there? Was that – is that to some degree – to break down a perception thing, do you think?
I would suspect so. I think there was a bit of cheekiness going on. I mean, no one who's come across a bunch of different audio would seriously suggest that a $200 20-watt per channel integrated would drive that system, which is really complex, as you say, vis-a-vis, I don't know, a $20,000, $30,000 state-of-the-art pre-power. It's just simple physics. It can't be right. I think what Harry Pearson was trying to do is to say, listen, just because stuff is cheap doesn't mean it can't sound good and it can't work. I mean, there's stuff out there that I've heard over the years, it's, you know, sub $2,000, and I don't think that's a lot of money in hi-fi these days. Might have been 20, 30 years ago, but certainly not now. That sounds absolutely amazing.
Oh, there is still amazing hi-fi bargains. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Many things floating around my head. I want to come back to a perception related to large, complex speakers and amplifiers, sure, that need to drive them. But Peter Como, in a recent episode on this very podcast, went on and on about that exact perception you're referring to, the one where, it's inexpensive, it can't be any good. And I want to put a bit of flesh on that for 2 seconds, is that what definitely can't be any good if it's an inexpensive product is the quality of the materials, the standard that it's made to, and where it's made can't be the same as a more expensive product. So it will have to be made in China or Vietnam or India. It will have to be made out of lighter, poorer quality raw materials. The components will have to be of less expensive sourcing. So that's a fact. But what's not a fact is that the result can't sound truly engaging and enjoyable. And I know that's what he meant. He probably doesn't, as a manufacturer or designer more than the manufacturer, but working for a manufacturer of highly regarded loudspeakers, but nonetheless ones that are at the affordable end of the market and mostly are made in Southeast Asia to keep the price... Well, Southeast Asia isn't China, is it?
Technically speaking, no, but anyway, yeah, we know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So you do have to cut some corners on build quality.
Of course.
But the perception is there that, it's a less expensive product, it can't sound great. And I have to say that the Lintons, which he designed some years ago now, long before probably I realised it was... I knew Peter Como in the sense that I knew of him, but I didn't know that he was the designer at Wharfdale when I listened to that speaker. And would there have been a perception there if I had known it was his work? I didn't know whose it was. I turned them on and went, wow, these are a lot of fun to listen to.
Correct.
So they're not perfect, of course, and they're not built to the standard of a Magico, of course. So that's part of what you get. It's the same way as a cheap, fun car is cheap and it's fun, but it's not going to be built to the standard of a McLaren. So here's the other perception, and I'll let you speak.
Oh, shucks, thanks.
On your own subject. This is a perception you and I both, when you hear me say it, will go, we've been talking about this for a lifetime to clients.
Yep.
Is you've got a large pair of speakers you're trying to sell someone, and they immediately go, I'm going to need a big amplifier to drive that. The bigger the speaker, their perception is that the bigger the amplifier you need to drive it. When actual fact, I can assure you, and someone like Peter Como will confirm this, and I think we may have discussed it in the same conversation, is that, of course, a smaller amplifier is in fact required, because the speaker is almost certainly more full range and more sensitive.
Correct.
And quite possibly easier to drive. Quite possibly harder to drive, but a well-designed larger speaker, in fact, is easier to drive always than a small speaker, just because of sensitivity. Moving right along, other perceptions in the hi-fi world?
The corollary of that, I guess, is looking at expensive esoterica. I'm not going to name names, but we all know the companies that I'm talking about. And intrinsically, because they are rare, exotic, and very expensive, they naturally must sound better. Now, this is just my personal experience. A lot of the times, the answer is yes, they do, under the correct circumstances, because as you go up to the pointy end of the market, sometimes things require various tickling and bowing and, tuning.
I have a perception, which is that the more expensive the system, the more mucking around it needs to get
the best out of it. But I guess that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Not all the time, but that's generally the case. But I have walked into shows around the world and customers' houses with insanely expensive esoterica, and I'm thinking, gee, I've heard $10,000 systems sound better.
Yeah, yeah. I'll let out a secret right here and now about me, and that is, I kind of mostly don't believe in the super high end at all. And people go, well, of course you don't. No one who's sane does. In some ways, it's kind of for those McLaren owners. It's them to dabble with, isn't it? But I just find a lot of thoroughly enjoyable sound quality in the $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 area of the market. I just feel like, and people are going, well, lucky you that you can afford to spend that much. No, I've never had a $40,000 system owned. Well, I have owned it, of course. I've owned shops full of equipment, but you don't feel like you own it because it comes and goes, and you just pay bills and customers give you money. It's not as if you own it, even though you kind of do. But yeah, I just don't feel like my system at home at the moment is worth $12,000, and I love it. You know, it's not perfect, far from it, of course, but it gives me a lot of pleasure.
Well, isn't that the end goal of any system?
Yeah, I mean, that's what it's all about, I think. And then how you spend that money within that system, there's another perception, isn't it?
Correct.
Do go on. I keep cutting you off. We might re-record this, where turn my microphone off. Fucking show.
Is that right? Language, sir.
I've decided we're going to swear more.
Really? Just for a bit of spice, hey? we're using swear words as a semantic underscore, though, aren't we?
I listened to everyone else's podcast. There's only about three audio podcasts in the world worth listening to.
Oh, dear.
This is one of them, I hope. They drop all sorts of words in, quite naturally, and I think it's part of the. If we weren't recording this, would we swear? Eh, not much, but we might a bit. Continue.
Mm. Okay, so yeah, look, the corollary you brought up with automotive vehicles is pretty good. I mean, when you get to the pointy end of the automotive market, and we're talking Lamborghini, Ferrari, Bugatti. Things like that, and certainly McLaren, and there's other heaps of other marks, kind of Koenigsegg, the rest of them. Look, you know, most rational people would look at those cars and go, you've got to be fucking crazy spending $500,000
there
and north.
He's into the swearing thing. Yeah. Keep going.
$500,000 and north because of all the attendant anxiety that you would have with ownership. For instance,
the cost of owning those cars is diabolical.
Servicing, the insurance would be through the roof. It doesn't matter how pigeon-chested you may feel when you hop into your Hurricane or whatever and you tootle down the road to get a bottle of milk or, you know, whatever it is these days people buy. I'd have my heart in my mouth thinking some prick's going to smash into this or key it out of sheer spite or whatever. But look, I've driven cars that are like a tiny fraction of that price and have given me infinite glee without the anxiety. Mm. And I think the same is kind of true with audio. Mm-hmm. There's some audio that is audio gear, I should say, that is just made really competently. It looks good. It's not audio jewelry. And that's no disrespect to the stuff that's beautifully machined, because I do love that. But it gets out of the way. And that's what all systems should do. It should just get out of the way of the music.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I look, I think talking about hi-fi is different to buying it and listening to it.
Agreed.
Because we can happily talk about all sorts of stuff, but when you get down to it, you know, and this quickly becomes a lesson in how not to buy a hi-fi system. Don't spend too little money.
Mm.
But don't spend too much, really.
But there always is an inflection point in markets, and hi-fi is a great example of that. I mean, I've had clients in the past come in and they've got, you know, they're crossing their arms, almost doing battle before they walk through the door, saying, "I've done my research and I know what I want," you know. And I'm going, "Oh God, here we go." I actually had a person once with you're not going to believe this. Well, maybe you will. he had an Excel spreadsheet. printed out.
Really?
With all the, you know, all the furrowed brow empirical specifications and costs. And I'm thinking, well, that's nice. You have indeed done your research, sir. And then he had a transcript from ChatGTP. Yeah, with ChatGTP's recommendation for the components. Now, I'm thinking, look, I know large language models are getting more sophisticated and everyone's duking it out in that space, but I don't know if any large language model can actually have oral perception. Do you?
No.
No.
No, in fact...
No.
Well, I mean, the clue is in the title. It's artificial intelligence.
Ooh, very, very nice, very nice. But look, it's true. So what I, by that, I don't mean to denigrate that individual who did that. And he had his best intentions. But the point is, you can jabber on all you want. You can read all the magazines you want. At the end of the day, you've got to sit down and listen to the stuff.
You know, we're going off on a tangent. Huh? It's a surprise. But I don't know why people get so stressed about it.
Mm.
I mean, a lot of customers, you know... actually don't. You know, they come in and they're kind of there to buy from you, I guess, because, you know, they've heard the word that you're fairly honest and straightforward, do a decent demonstration and give it some, you know, sell a good product at a sensible price and give you some backup service. They arrive, show me what, this is what my room's like, this is what I listen to, this is how loud I want to listen to it or not, this is my hope. You play them two or three different sort of quick systems to give them different presentation styles, if you like, and they go, oh, I like that one, and then you head down a bit of a path, and then in 2 hours they've walked out with a very nice system.
Correct.
And then there's the ones who want to do battle with their spreadsheets.
Oh yeah.
Like I never quite understand that. It's so, going back to cars again, buying cars are really easy if you like cars, and these people are meant to like hi-fi music, right? You go and you just drive a few different cars, you look at them, you go, it looks good, I've just driven it, drives brilliantly, or it's as, you know, it's a Golf R and it's the dullest thing you've ever driven in your life, one or the other. And so I say that because I once drove a Golf R all excited and it was so uninteresting. It was,
I've had that with audio gear, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, that's not what I hoped it would be. Indeed, at all. Bugger, yeah. I wanted to buy that, and you move on to, you have to buy something else. But it's as easy as find the thing that's fun.
Correct.
So, you know, and actually, good analogy, because in that same car buying trip, I ended up spending a lot less money on a different car that's a lot more fun to drive than a Golf R, and was $20,000 cheaper or something. It's probably nearly as well made. Still made in Germany. So what I'm saying is the same applies to audio, doesn't it?
Mm.
I think we're, are we still talking perceptions?
Well, but, we're slightly off. But look, the thing is, you know, it's great to see the body language when customers walk in and they sit down and listen to various stuff. And some of them have predetermined perceptions of what they want to buy. I want to buy speaker X. Oh, okay. And then you qualify them and you say, well, you know, kind of what amp are you considering and how big's your room and what genres do you listen to and all that jazz. And that's... evidently, with some, not all, but some of them, it's kind of like down the totem pole a bit. You know, I've read the reviews or I've seen the YouTube, you know, insert favorite reviewer here, saying that this is the best thing since sliced bread. And you go, okay, well, yeah, let's have a listen to the sliced bread. And you do. And then you gently say, but sir, madam, have you considered other sliced bread? And I play the other sliced bread and they go, oh.
Yeah, that's an interesting – now, there is a perception there, which is that the marketing and the reviews have led the potential client to believe, have a perception –
this is precisely that
this
my
is the
point.
Yeah, this is the brand for them. And, of course, we both know how this story ends. In so many cases, you play the product that they are in love with as they walked through the door, and they're like, oh, I thought it would – my perception was it would sound different to
exactly.
that. And then you ask, of course, oh, in what way, sir, madam? Quite often madam, actually, in retail, isn't it? You know, it does happen. It's not all blokes. And then they go, oh, I thought it'd be more like this. You go, well, I've got something for you. And you play them this different system or different loudspeaker, different DAC, different turntable, whatever it is. And they go, oh, yeah, that's more like it. So I guess you're meeting their perception. I mean, it's not even a perception. I guess it's what they want. I want it to sound like this.
Mm.
My perception was that brand X nearly said brand something
this
else.
This is the kernel was of my argument.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, it's I'm not making a judgment on people because, let's face it, at least in this fair land, we're not in Europe. We're not in the Northern America. We don't have the sheer density of population and, indeed, the number and, indeed, the quality of retail outlets that those continents share. You've got a handful of dealers in the country and, you know, I remember the arrogance of some reviewers saying, oh, if you really want to know what it sounds like, just pop into your local shop. And I'm thinking, well, if you're 500 kilometres away from a capital city, you ain't going to be popping into a local shop. So this is where reviews both written, both on the web and on Flat Dead Trees with Ink, and YouTube are really valuable. And
They are, aren't they? And
valuable.
I like reading reviews.
No, I find them fascinating. I find them entertaining and insightful.
Because but there is a perception, do you think?
Of course there is. And and this is what I'm trying to say. When people come into stores, invariably they carry a notion in their head about, I want to listen to this or I want to hear this because so-and-so said it was good. And three or four so-and-so said it's good. So it must be true. And look, I'm not saying it isn't, but with that thin sliver of information that they've received, there's a bigger reality out there.
Can I just say one thing on that?
Sure.
Without turning this episode into a nasty, bad, negative episode. But the thing is, if you've got five reviewers all saying that some product's great, that officially probably never, but definitely at the moment, if the YouTube videos means utterly nothing. Because you've got to remember or understand how YouTube works.
Indeed.
Someone famous does a review on some new product that's quite good, and they say it's quite good. But the YouTube world, they all follow. They all want that same product. They all want to bounce off that traffic. So people are looking at an interesting product on the most popular reviewing site, or one of them. They then dredge down through the internet and find more. I want to find more information on that. That's what they want to do, and therefore the other YouTube reviewers are there to serve that up. We're going to also review. And so if you see a pattern, I mean, people are going, well, of course, duh. Did you just work it out? No, I've known for a while, but we don't talk about it much. But there's such an obvious pattern between, say, the top five YouTube product reviewers pretty much all reviewing the same stuff. So it's easy to get five reviews where they all say it's good. And by the way, the problem with reviewing that none of us have ever worked out how to deal with is that no one wants to say a product's bad. And actually, there isn't really any bad products anymore in a way. It's taste and whether it's your thing, but just because there's five reviews say it's good doesn't mean either it's your taste or that it's really that competitive, I think. You heard it here first. I really don't. Do you have thoughts on that? Like, I mean, because
look, it's
easy to find five reviews of a product that you and I would both agree is not much fun to listen to.
Well, yeah, and it's
doesn't happen often, but it happens.
No, and again, this is not a negative thing. It's just the reality of the marketplace. I mean, it's free enterprise capitalism. Whether we're talking, certain Korean mega companies owning half the brands, modesty forbids me from uttering the word Samsung. But whether it's that or whether it's some well-meaning bloke in a shed knocking out a speaker or a amp or whatever, the point is they're there to make money. And I'm not saying there's some kind of nefarious motivation there, because I'm sure that whether it's Samsung or whether it's an independent manufacturer, they both want the best for the consumer because it's in their interest to want the best for the consumer. Yeah. But let's be real here. The thing is, this has happened for decades. It's not just the post internet age kind of thing. It's certainly happened with print media, and what's left of print media now is the separation between the advertising department and the review department. This Chinese wall between the two is just nonsensical. And I've mentioned this much to my what's the word. Yeah, much to my horror with a few people. And I'm just waiting for them to take me to the kind of the pyre and light the match and set me ablaze. But we don't talk about this. It's marketing, it's commerce, it's what we do. Doesn't mean it's a diametric, it's all good or it's all bad. Just be aware that people are out to sell stuff. And that's a good thing, but at the end of the day, you've really got to try and listen to stuff for yourself.
There's a kind of a balance, though, isn't there?
Indeed.
There's a balance in all things. Running a hi-fi retailing business and making customers happy at the same time as making money is a tricky balancing act.
Absolutely.
But it can be done. You can be honest and put forward what you prefer. Have a listen to this. I love it. Not only do I love it, but it's imported or manufactured by some nice people. They give great support, good backup service. They don't question you when you have a claim. Maybe it's a rare event, but when it happens, they get on it. There's all sorts of reasons why a good retailer deals with certain products, and ultimately, it's to make customers happy.
Correct.
And make money, or vice versa, whichever way you look at it.
Well, if you don't have customers, you're never going to make money.
No. So it's – and that's where if the perception thing is there, but really we're just talking about – I guess life would be simpler for the people at the coalface if the customers just relaxed a bit, had a bit of fun.
Well, so some of them.
I like buying things. Like, I rarely go and buy anything, but when I do,
it's fun.
I like to have fun.
Absolutely.
And guess what? And I'm constantly reminded of this by my partner in life, that I always give the sale to the happiest, nicest, friendliest, most professional person. And she's, you paid more for that, like. Yeah, but I enjoyed it.
I'm very, very much cut from the same cloth.
That's not to say that she's not against spending money. It's just she observes. She can, because she knows me, she observes that that's what I've done.
But shouldn't that be part of the process to actually walk into a store and have an engaging kind of relationship with whoever's selling you whatever or demonstrating whatever. I don't want some kind of dry kind of, interaction. I have those dry interactions on the web every day. I mean, I want a human being selling to another human being.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want them to infect me with the enthusiasm that they have for gear A, B, and C.
Yeah, you could bring into the analogy restaurants. Everyone's having a... The food tastes better when the service is good.
Unquestionably.
Now, that's perception.
Of course it is.
So much perception in food and wine, it's ridiculous. But, so back to hi-fi perceptions. We'll have a quick break. We'll have a quick break, back in a flash, with not just the tail end of the perception discussion, but, of course, moving on to the 10 things you absolutely need to take care of for maximum turntable pleasure. Hey Now Hi-Fi specializes in creating personalized audio experiences with brands to suit all needs and over 3 decades of experience. Jeff from Hey Now Hi-Fi can help find your sound for your life. Have a look at the website now. Not right now. You're listening to the podcast later, but soon. And we're back. David Carazza, Andrew Hutchison discussing perception and turntables. And we will get to the turntable thing in a minute. But David, I have sidetracked you on the perception discussion badly, so we need to refocus. Fire away.
Okay. I don't want to speak too much longer about it because this can go for hours.
Should we do a summary, though?
Yeah.
Do your remaining points and then let's summarise what we're really getting at.
Okay. Because
it'll save you money.
Well, it probably will. Look, we're all human, and we're all influenced by our peers, professional people in the marketplace. Certainly, the media, unquestionably, and that's not a bad thing because there is a modicum of professionalism and truth in those recommendations.
Absolutely.
Especially, working professionals who work in retail hi-fi have amassed years of experience and they actually know what works and what doesn't work together. It's that funny thing called synergy. So they can save you a lot of time and heartache.
Indeed.
What will happen, though, is I think not all people, but a lot of people, especially who are starting out, as I mentioned earlier, predicate their choices on print media, YouTube, and forums on the net. And whilst that's a nice starting point, it's not the end point.
Mm-hmm.
You've ultimately got to put your stake in the ground and go, okay, this is my budget. This is what I want from a system. That's your starting point.
Mm-hmm.
What do I want to feel when I sit down? And that will then inform you.
Yeah, what do we
you.
Want to feel? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's how should I put this? I don't know. I mean, look, honestly, I've been flogging hi-fi to people since I was 15. I'm not going to say how old I am now, but
substantially more than 15.
Yes, over 20. And yes, there's patterns you see, there's so many things I could say. I could go on and on about it. I do feel that because people are concerned with being tricked into spending more money or buying a brand that they don't want to buy, which is such a strange thing.
Mm.
But perhaps they're mainly concerned with being tricked into spending more money than they really are comfortable with or their partner in life would like them to spend. They are on edge when they go into a shop. But the only way to learn what you actually want is to listen to a broad range of options.
Are we recording?
Yes, we never stopped.
Good.
That's how this works, David. We record it and then I cut the bad bits out, some of them, all of them.
There'll be nothing left.
And then I upload it to the internet.
I'm not the village idiot. It's just you were gibbling to yourself and doing something on the laptop, and I'm thinking,
I was writing a note that says I had to cut a bit out.
I'm glad you did.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's right. And funny things too, just anecdotally, very quickly, there are moments when people will, as you correctly say, come into a store and do battle, thinking that, you know, the person selling you the stuff is the adversary. And look, a lot of the times it's simply not the case. A lot of the people in stores are literally trying to help them get the best sound for the buck.
Mm.
And sometimes if you're not exposed to something that's only 10, 15% more expensive,
yeah.
I mean, you know, what do you want to do? Spend X number of dollars, go home and grit your teeth thinking, I'm not really happy with it, or spend X plus 15% and go, wow, he or she sold me something fantastic and I'm forever grateful that they opened my eyes to this.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's – admittedly, the hi-fi salesman has a suite of tools available to them, which is simply better equipment to prize more money from you. But go down that path a little bit and have a listen and see what you think, because you might realise that, yeah, actually – there's a good reason to buy, say, the Riga Planer 3 rather than the 1, even though it's, I guess it's $800 or $900 more these days. You've only got to buy it once. It lasts for 30 years.
Yeah, no shit, Sherlock.
So it's very much a false economy to buy.
Correct.
P1, as it's called these days, it's a lovely machine. Stop making this. But the P3 is so much better in every way.
Just
to use a very general example that everyone knows about. Speaking of turntables.
You don't say.
Beautiful segue. If I say so myself. Ask me questions about turntables, David.
Okay. Let's talk about how to set up a turntable because, okay, people who have had turntables in the past probably know what are the do's and the don'ts, both physically and operationally with turntables. But if you're a neophyte, whether you're 40, 50-something getting back into the game or you're a teenager thinking, wow, this flat black stuff looks really good, where do you start?
Well, you buy a decent turntable.
Correct. You don't buy a Crosley.
No. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, now let's cover that right now. So
indeed.
Point one, there are turntables and record players, which used to be the oldie world term to imply something less than a turntable, transcription turntable.
Ooh.
And what we mean to keep this, because this, I think this, this very, this to the point discussion is meant to be kept as much for the beginner to records as to the experienced user.
Definitely.
I think everyone might get something from this. This is coming from someone who's had the misfortune to be fixing turntables and setting them up for a few years now. So, yeah, a record player. Well, anything, if you're buying a turntable or a record player from, and I'm just going to, oh, no, I won't say the brand of the store, but if you're buying it from an appliance store, you're probably not buying a turntable because they don't range serious turntables or record players. I think the term's interchangeable now, isn't it? So Crosley is an example of something that's possibly the worst piece of shit ever known to records and record playing. It doesn't really play a record. It scratches a diamond through a groove to the vinyl all goes away, basically.
Diamond? Woo-hoo.
Well, I think
I thought a lower-grade sapphire would be more like
it. Yeah, who knows? But yeah, come on, people. Yeah. So entry-level is absolutely a basic project or a basic any of those entry-level proper hi-fi turntables, a Riga, a Project, there's a couple of others.
Yeah, some of the Audio Technica stuff's beautiful too.
Yeah, they do have a couple of good ones. Yes, yeah. The $199 one is obviously to be avoided, but and as would there be $299? Oh, let's just generalise and say from $400 or $500 Australian, or I guess $300 or $400 in the US currency, €300, €300, £300, something like that. From those price points and above, you are going to buy a proper turntable.
Correct.
But in the first sort of doubling of that price, there will be other models that will be much better. So may I quickly suggest that spending perhaps $1,000 to $1,500 Australian or around $600 to $1,000 US or euro or pound is a better way to go. Now, that sounds like weird advice. You're just talking about the price.
It's hardly agreed upon because I've just seen it too many times when people have, you know, they've scrimped, you know, for a couple of $100 they've got basically landfill. They could have spent a few $100 more and got something that, as you correctly say, would have lasted them 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, and on that front, when I say 30, that's an exaggeration perhaps because you will need to have maintained it. But this is a thing that will work for 10 or 20 years without really being touched. A belt will last more than 10 years if it's a belt drive, and in this price range it will be. Don't buy a cheap direct drive. We should quickly cover vintage.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, by all means buy a used turntable, but you will be spending some money with someone like me getting it to be made right, which is touching on all these other things I'm about to go into. All those other things will need to be done to this machine, whereas a new one will work. Second-hand one will not work unless you've bought it from a shop that has fully serviced, repaired it. And I don't mean a hi-fi shop in this case. I mean from some kind of repair shop / perhaps a used shop that does fix them up properly. I can think of one store in Sydney and Newtown that probably would sell you one that is actually ready to use. Now, so that's a super turntable basic, buy a turntable. But there is that important, and people go, oh, but I've got this, oh, grandma's got this beautiful radiogram. It's a radiogram. It's a piece of crap. If it's got Garrard written on it, unless it's a 301, you know, Garrard and BSR made these horrible record changes. You stack five or six records up and they go bang, 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 playing the albums out of sequence, which just, that's the thing that annoys me the most.
Can you imagine the VTA changing every half hour?
It's just that. It's the, so we're going to listen to side one of The Wall, and then we're going to listen to side one of,
yeah, yeah. This is horror.
When are we listening to side two, Dad? Oh, we've got to listen to these other five side ones first. Then we'll flip them all over, and then we'll.
Can we stop? Let's move on.
Do not buy it. Do not waste money on a radiogram, stereogram. People are saying, "What's that?" It's a giant wooden box with a crappy record changer in it, crappy speakers probably built into it, an awful 12-watt amplifier. Just don't go there. They were shit when they were new and they only got worse with age. Now I'm getting annoyed. I got 10 things here.
Let's go.
So first thing is, if it's a brand new turntable, you don't need to worry about most of these 10 things. but you will need to keep your stylus clean. Now, we touched on this in a previous episode, five hi-fi myths or something, I think it was called. Styluses get dirty the minute they – at the end of track one, it's filthy, probably. But not filthy with anything that probably matters. But if you do that 10, 20, 30, 40 times, as in play, you know, say 10 records, your stylus needs cleaning. Crud is building up. It's jacking the stylus up out of the groove. It's not tracking correctly. You're not getting the right sound quality. So how are you going to clean it? Well, I'll leave this to David. I don't know. what do you sell for a stylus brush at the moment?
Well, there's a number of things. A Project make a great cleaner. There's a number of third parties. Audio Technica make simple brushes and liquids and all that jazz. And that's the absolutely bare minimum. Like back in the day, dishwasher did their cleaner and their stylus cleaner, which were great. I honestly don't know.
Well, they were the reference, I think.
They were, and they were pretty damn good and for not a lot of money. But, you know, once you go down the rabbit hole, as I have once done, you can get into esoterica, like, you know, kind of vacuum record cleaners. There's some German manufacturers that do it. VPI were the famous ones that did it. Certainly Project make one. But also there's ultrasonic cleaners where you bathe the vinyl in I know, don't look at me like that. And look, it becomes extraordinarily anal and pointy headed, but you know, if it's fine for you and it works, that's great. But you'd be surprised, because I've done some ultrasonic cleaning with allegedly new discs, and the amount of stuff that comes off is frightening.
Speaking of that, and then I'll come back to my simple recipe that I will suggest to keep things simple. Small investment, simple record and stylus cleaner. But before we do that, there's someone we spoke to, a bit of cross promotion here, on another podcast episode where we interviewed a number of people at the Sydney Hi-Fi Show earlier in the year. Spoke to Steve at Secret Chord. He makes a record cleaner product. It's one of those pour it over your record and peel it off things. Now, we just were appraised of a review that he received the other day. He sent us, because it was from someone who was our customer in the repair shop and in the Delacord business, and that was the connection. That's why he sent us a review, no doubt with the client's permission. Don't know how that works, but we all know the guy, and he's a nice guy. Point is, he had a record that was really, really unplayable, and he used Steve's stuff, Secret Chord, sticky record cleaner stuff. It brought it back like new, he says. So I'm just saying, you might want to check that out. He has some test sachets of one side, and that's what he used, and it was incredibly good. No doubt he's bought the whole kit now. The simple solution for cleaning, I reckon, now, after a lifetime of doing it, it used to be SC2 and D4 dishwasher when I was a child. I've still got the D4 brush. Everyone's got one, but it's now so old it's almost shedding like a, you know, like an old
dog.
No one wants that. So Audio Technica have a brush. It's a round sort of elliptical shaped face with some fluid. It's very similar to a D4 brush. I put that forward as a pretty bloody good record cleaning brush. And as we discussed in the previous program, I think their fluid stylus cleaner, if used only as often as you need to, I think is absolutely the go. Unfortunately, I feel a lot of the carbon fiber stylus brushes are a bit, don't have enough mojo to get to rip the crap off the stylus. They'll never damage your stylus. They'll never tear the tip out of the cantilever, because the carbon fiber hairs don't really get hold of stuff. If it's just fluff, they'll do an okay job, but eventually you get this ground in gunk that goes hard, and that's where you need the fluid. Can't overstate how important it is to keep particularly the stylus clean, but of course if your records aren't clean, the stylus gets dirty really fast. Yep. So that would be the number one thing that would stop you from having good sound, assuming a new turntable and everything's set up properly. We're going to keep talking new turntables because it makes it simpler, and then we'll come back to the what's going to affect used ones. I'm going to pick things at random because I'm just looking at my list, and I just saw phono stages.
Yeah, for sure.
How the hell do you plug this turntable into your system? Obviously the salesman will take care of this for you if you tell them what you have, or you've bought the whole system from them, they'll make sure it works. But a moving magnet cartridge is the most likely affordable cartridge you're going to have. We'll talk about the differences in cartridges in a second. You're going to need something to plug it into. What are you selling in an affordable but very high performance phono stage these days, David?
Look, it's hard to go past the Riga stuff. For the
kind of is, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. Well, in this country, it's 500 Australian pesos, and it's pretty good. You've got to spend substantially.
I reckon
more.
It's better than pretty good. You're talking about the specific moving magnet one.
Yeah, the moving magnet one. Yeah. Well,
because they have a less expensive one.
Yeah, they do. But the $500 price point one is pretty amazing. You'd have to spend a couple of grand to get a better one, in my humble estimation.
I wholeheartedly agree. That's a pearler of a fino stage.
It is,
and the moving coil version of that is also a stunner for the money. Sounds like an ad. It's actually
not.
No, annoyingly. No money coming to us from that. You need it. If your amplifier doesn't have a moving magnet input with a little earth screw, it'll probably be marked phono.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you need to get an outboard stage. It's like an extra box plugged between the turntable and the amplifier. It'll plug back separately into the wall to get its power. You will get a better result with an external phono preamp in almost every case, except maybe a super entry-level one from JCAR for $49. Don't buy that. The project is the cheapest that's worth plugging in.
Agreed.
I think it's actually quite affordable. So you need a phono stage, either built into your amp or external. Get on it. Signal leads I've got here... highly overrated. Let's not go there. You know, if we're talking affordable turntables, you need a functional lead. You don't buy a $7 lead. The lead that there'll be one affixed to your turntable. You do not need to upgrade that. Please don't go down.
There's
that
other
path.
Fish to fry before.
Yeah. And the other fish to fry is my next thing, which is cartridge upgrades, stylus shape. There's a conversation.
Boy, there's so many stylus shapes around.
Stylus shapes, so many cartridges.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make recommendations on cartridges because...
It's
personal taste. They all sound a bit different. Everyone has their favourites. I mean, probably the two biggies are Audio-Technica and Audifon, but there's a million others.
Yeah, there's heaps.
Stylus shape does make a difference. You've got in rough order of... quality, you've got conical,
then elliptical.
Elliptical, but bonded elliptical.
Yes.
And then nude elliptical.
Nude elliptical.
That doesn't mean it gets around without its clothes on.
Ooh, how naughty.
Yeah, but what it means and why it's described as nude elliptical, I don't know. It's basically that the whole stalk attached to the cantilever is made from diamond. Contiguous piece of diamond.
Yeah.
And then above that you have many other shapes.
Well, you've got the hyper-ellipticals, you've got the...
Ooh, hyper-elliptical sounds interesting.
Yeah, hyper-elliptical, micro-line. You've got Shibata, which is, if it's aligned correctly, sounds great, and if it's a tenth of a micron out, it's good night, Irene. You've also got some weird and wonderful stuff, like Bang & Olufsen used to make a profile called the Pramanak. One of their engineers, Pramanak, strangely enough, did the profile. This is back in the CD4 days. When Bang & Olufsen had their turntable, the 4004, which was a parallel tracking turntable, but with this special cartridge, so you could properly decode CD4.
CD4 did require, which is early surround sound of 1974, basically.
Yeah.
End of 73 to the start of 75, and it was gone. It needed extra information because that's what we're talking about here. Like Shibata,
Pramanak, things like that. Yeah. Shibata would track CD4. CD4 was really elegant for a totally analog system. It was just sheer genius. They had a carrier frequency above the standard, left and right channel, 20 to 20 kilohertz.
And
this carrier frequency was decoded by the cartridge with an analog decoder at the other end. It was just extraordinary.
You're telling me things I don't know about.
Well, the fact that it worked at all is just amazing.
Yeah, and I have to say, as much as I've fixed a whole bunch of that gear over the years, mainly of the, borderline radiogram variety, though Technics made a really nice little console, little system. It wasn't really a radiogram. It was much better than that.
Yeah.
It had it, and there was a Sharp had those, and there was a few others, quite nice sort of whole console type stereos with matching four speakers, yeah, you know, yeah. And there were more serious stuff. But the point is, why do you have a different shape stylus, David? Mm-hmm. To dredge out more information.
And the good thing about, you know, the styli that have a bigger contact area, like the Micro Lions, the Shibata, et cetera, if you're buying secondhand records, and who isn't these days, if you've got something that's quite worn, and inevitably it'll be from a spherical stylus or more than likely an elliptical, there's other parts of the wall that remain untouched. And these Micro Lines and Shibata can extract that, and you get this fantastic sound.
Yes.
But it does require proper setup, far more than elliptical.
Which brings us to the next thing. If you are upgrading your cartridge, you're going to need to have a professional install it, because alignment and mounting is critical, and not to mention there's damage that can be done in the process. Do not fit a new cartridge yourself unless you have done it before and have all the right tools. Just don't go there. Don't be the multiple guys and one woman who've brought their turntables in recently with the leads all torn out of the end of the arm, head shell leads from a fixed head shell. That's always exciting to fix. And go, the guy that sold me the cartridge said it was a DIY job. I watched a YouTube video, but now here I am with a broken turntable. You just get a pro to do it. There's a bunch of things to adjust when you do a cartridge, so this is a nice little segue into what the other few critical things are. Alignment, basic overhang alignment. Now, I've had three cartridges on turntables come in the last three jobs. Mm-hmm. The cartridge has been skewed in the head shell bolts slots in all three jobs, and I've said,
"Wow,
what happened here? I fitted a new cartridge. I just had to align it properly. That's not how you align a cartridge." So you can print out your paper aligning doohickey off the internet if you want. Just search, you know, cartridge alignment tool, paper, print. Only print, you know, self print, whatever. But you do keep the cartridge in the head shell bolts square, if you like, to the head shell. You actually don't really align the cartridge to the aligner. You really align the head shell in a way, and that's what's called overhang, because you slide the cartridge backwards and forwards until, with the head shell square to the alignment lines, the tip of the cartridge is sitting in the right on the mark where it's meant to. So that's why it's called an overhang adjustment, I guess. That's how you do it. If that doesn't make any sense, you shouldn't be doing it, and you just bring it to someone to do it for you. Now, most places that sell a serious cartridge will be able to do a serious alignment, but maybe not all, but, you know, most. An Australian loudspeaker legend has been born with the stunning new VAF Research i93 Mark V, winner of StereoNet's Floor Standing Loudspeaker Product of the Year and Sound and Image Magazine's Floor Standing Speaker of the Year, $20,000 to $50,000. VAF's i93 has redefined what I thought was possible from a loudspeaker in a domestic setting, says StereoNet. VAF Research, building award-winning loudspeakers in Australia since 1978. I'm quite good at a few things. And one thing that I'm really bad at, and there's lots of things I'm really bad at, but one thing I'm really bad at is explaining things. I couldn't be a school teacher. So don't write in. No, write in. Comment on the YouTube channel about how poorly I explain these relatively simple things. David, anything else that occurs to you that's important with turntables? I've got a few, but you go.
Just really basic stuff that people don't even articulate. Like, make sure it's on a damn level surface.
Ah, that'd be a good start, yes.
Well,
yes.
You know, as Roy Gandhi used to say, you know, turntables are a vibration measurement machine. That's basically what they are.
Yes.
And if you don't have kind of laterally properly placed turntables, good luck with your alignments and everything.
That anti-skating force will need to be adjusted if you're going to lean it on an angle. Yes. You'll have to fudge it up a bit.
And just make sure that it's not in a place in the room where it's, you know, at some bizarre resonant frequency where, I know we're going to go on to lids, but if it has a lid, where the lid will howl and excite and all that jazz. I mean, a lot of really interesting turntables no longer have lids, and I that's probably a good thing. Domestically, it's probably a bad thing if you've got kids or cats or a lot of dust. Just the physical stuff. Forget about all the micro-tuning of the cartridge, etc. Just make sure it's on a flat surface, it's non-resonant, and, that's a good start.
Yeah, I would add to that that this surface, this non-resonant surface, which could be, preferably not a $400 TV cabinet, because that probably would be quite resonant. But let's say it's a proper hi-fi rack, you know, an affordable one that's fairly non-resonant, that's level and designed, you know, to
and couples to the floor nicely.
Yeah, yeah, and it's designed to have a turntable on.
Yep.
But you know, maybe not. But whatever, something a solid surface, right? Here's the thing: don't put the speakers each side of it. On the same shelf.
Do you know how many times I have to explain why you shouldn't do that?
Well, we're going
to
explain it right now.
Okay.
Because I've got a note here. It says point 0.5, acoustic feedback. So if your speakers vibrate, that's how they move air and make sound.
Is that right?
Yeah. And so how does the turntable work? Well, it doesn't want to vibrate ideally, so hence the non-resonant surface. So, yeah, if you've got the speakers on the same table, if we were using a table or maybe a bench or a buffet or a shelf.
A credenza.
I don't know what you said.
Yeah.
I couldn't hear you over listening to my own voice.
Aye, there's the rub.
The speakers will vibrate the cabinet. They will vibrate the turntable. They will vibrate the stylus. You will then have the same kind of feedback loop that you have
in a Crossley.
Yeah.
I couldn't resist.
I was going to say in a PA system at a race course or something. Yeah, okay. So much of a race course. I don't know. Just someone gets up on stage, they grab the mic, get that little whistle because they pointed the mic at the speakers. Yeah. That's a feedback loop.
Correct.
Only in this case it's an acoustic feedback loop. Yeah, no, the speakers need to be mounted on a separate platform to the turntable. And, I mean, in an ideal world, if you're living in a home with a timber floor, suspended timber floor, not just a timber floor laid over concrete, but an actual house built on stumps, pylons or whatever the correct constructional term is. You got a bit of a problem, and that's where you were talking about like trying to find a spot in the room that's not resonant. What you can do if you're on a timber floor is you can find where the main joists are or the main posts.
Correct.
And sight the turntable over that on a hi-fi rack and then put the speakers on other posts. That way the floor actually isn't getting vibrated much. But as you walk across the floor...
It's like a very low-frequency trampoline.
Yes, it kind of is. And you'll know, anyone who lives on a timber floor and has a record player knows about this. So, yeah, acoustic feedback, don't do it. Lid up or lid down? Yeah, there was a bit of a... It was one of those audiophile things. You've got to listen with the lid up.
Yes.
So it traps the air around the cartridge. Yeah,
because with the lid up, it, the lid won't resonate if it's up or down, right?
What's that movement you're doing?
Oh, God. Just basic physics. I mean, people love these little... I don't know. They just don't think hard enough. Whether the lid is up or down, it's still going to resonate. Yes, I grant you that if it's down, it'll probably couple to the plinth and therefore the resonance will be worse, but it's still going to resonate. So take the bloody lid off if it's going to concern
I guess it couples at two more points, the forward ones, not just the hinges, but little rubber buttons or whatever that it sits on at the front, at, you know, the leading edge. But, yeah, get rid of the lid is
correct.
Probably how you get better sound. Take it off.
Correct.
You know? So if that's a thing. What else have I got here? How to use a turntable, David? Oh, I'm so easily dismayed at how people use turntables.
Is this a trick question? I'm not understanding where you're going.
There's an art to it.
Yeah, in terms of the actual playing of the disc.
Okay, can I run you through how I would play a record?
Yeah, please do.
So I would lift the lid.
Yes.
It's easier to get access to the platter that way. I would... Now, if it's a turntable with a manual switch for the motor, I would fire the motor up, get it, you know, get the bearing warmed up.
Correct.
I'd turn the amplifier on.
Yes.
I'd select the phono input. But before I did that, I'd turn the volume down. Select the phono input. Then I would clean the record if it needed cleaning, by putting the record on first. So we select some music, put the record on, and you go, geez, I can see in the light there a bit of surface crud, lint, dust, what have you. I'm going to use my Audio-Technica $49 brush and clean that off, either with or without fluid, depending on how bad it is, perhaps. And then I'm going to think about how clean that stylus is and the last time I did it, and I think, nah, it's okay, it's ready to go. And then I would lower the stylus into the groove at track one. Or maybe I'm sick of track one, I don't like it, I'm going to go to track two, whatever. Now, if I'm going to go to track two, I may use the cueing lever. But I'm just as likely to pick up the finger lifter,
yes,
with my index finger and thumb and balance my hand on the plinth of the turntable by using my little finger sort of to hold and support my wobbly hand and lower into the groove. It's so much more elegant than using the cueing lever. Plus, the cueing lever might be broken on your vintage turntable. I've just remembered that we didn't discuss any of those things that needed to be fixed on the vintage turntable.
Yeah, well, let's presuppose that everything's working, shall we?
We'll do that in another episode.
Great.
Sorry, vintage turntable lovers, we've run out of time. And then we will turn the volume up. You don't turn the volume up to your desired listening position and lower the stylus in the groove. People go, of course you don't. No, but I see it done all the time.
Yeah.
Or they want to skip a track and they don't turn the volume down. Now, in reality, you probably won't break anything, but your woofers will get a bit of a flogging and, you know, you'll get to be a loud low-frequency sound perhaps. Depends on the cartridge. What else have you got? Turntables.
That's mostly it. Just treat your records with respect. Make sure they're in a nice non-static, sleeve. Store them vertically away from light and heat.
Oh, speaking of B&O, and speaking of, if I mentioned this in podcasts before, but there's a, if you go to the B&O website,
yep.
I think I might have mentioned this. They've got a. I don't know if they're rejuvenating old turntables or whatever.
What they've taken is they've taken all the 4002s in circulation. Well, those people who want them restored or surrendered them, and they went through an insane process as only B&O could do.
Mm-hmm.
They reanodized the plates. They did a new color scheme. Everything was rebuilt from scratch, which is quite a feat considering all the stamping mechanisms and tooling for 4002s just haven't been around for 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
And they've resold them. I think it was maybe 100, 200 maximum.
I think it was 100.
Yeah. But they sell for 40,000 each and they're all gone.
Yeah, which is bizarre. But that's what makes this observation even more odd. So $40,000, probably euro or US dollars, proper dollars, proper currency, not shekels. And have a look at the – everyone's got to go to the website and have a look.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah. But have a look at the records.
Yeah.
There's piles and piles of records stacked up around this $40,000 turntable, like 50 records high stacked. What the hell?
It's a metaphor.
it's AI is what it is. It's terrible.
Yeah,
don't stack your records.
No, do not stack your records. Make sure they're vertical, sitting on the edge of the spine. Don't store them horizontally.
Please. They will warp is the point. The ones at the bottom
will. There's other stuff too that'll happen.
I think that's it. So 2-second summary.
Okay.
Stylus cleanliness, record cleanliness, correct tracking force, correct anti-skating force.
Yeah.
Lid up or off, or down, doesn't matter. Non-vibrational surface, nice sturdy surface, level.
Yes.
No acoustic feedback. Don't put your speakers on the same platform as the turntable sits on.
That's a good start.
I said alignment. I'm going to say it again if I didn't. Cartridge upgrades, absolutely under $1,000, generate improvements in sound quality, no doubt about it. Different shapes will access a different part of the groove on a secondhand record that will dredge up more information, more like it's a new record. Maybe a slight exaggeration, but it certainly happens. Don't spend time on signal lead changes. That's ridiculous. Do spend time on buying a decent phono stage, researching that, it makes a big difference. Have some fun.
Indeed.
David, it's been a pleasure.
As usual. Thank you, Andrew.
Yes. Love your company. And if only I'd let you talk.
Yes, many listeners contact me and they say, why does Andrew talk over you all the time?
And I go, I don't know. He's a rude turd. Speak to you again soon.
Okay.
Talk to you. Bye.
Bye.